Do you hear the one about the guy who couldn't afford personalized plate, so he went and changed his name to J3L2404?
Yeah, that's a good one.
TBTM.
That's clever.
Thank you.
It's not clever. It sure as hell isn't a good joke.
Guess what day it is? Guess what day it is?
It's Friday. Friday. Gotta get down on Friday. Everybody's looking forward to the weekend.
Because you're a chicken.
You're a chicken. Cuckoo ka-cha. Cuckoo ka-cha.
What are you doing?
Michael and women? A kudu-duga. That's what I was just telling you.
Has anyone in this family ever even seen a chicken?
I just might have tacos tonight. In Mysterio.
They think you're awesome. They think you're number one. They think you're the best. Wait, that didn't even spell anything, did it?
Well, hello, good morning, and welcome to a Friday edition of TBTL, the show that just might be too beautiful to live.
The most common side effect is diarrhea, sometimes severe.
We're working on that, by the way. We've almost completely eliminated that from the list of side effects to listening to this here imaginary radio program. My name is Luke Burbank. I'm your host.
Oh, la la.
Coming to you once again through the magic of audio recording from the studios of Walsh, Walsh and Doormat. In the Roosevelt neighborhood of Seattle, Washington, my friend and Cobro is applying Purell across the table from me furiously. During Thursday's recording, he somehow, I'm going to try to use a non-dirty word here, and I can't think of one, so I'm just going to say it. He sort of spooged Purell into his beard, into his mouth.
I didn't think you saw that. I'm sorry. You haven't introduced me yet. I didn't think that you saw that. I thought I got away with
some
that.
Some statements, though, they demand a response, and that was one that did. So I don't blame you for stepping into the fray before you've been officially introduced. By the way, that man right over there, my good friend, and I really mean that, the longest-running Cobro of the show, he is Andrew Walsh. That's the sound he makes as he's... Shoot. What were you were smelling the Purell and you but you were squeezing the small bottle. I'm not trying to embarrass you.
We gotta talk about this. In fact, I mean I'm glad to know that you saw it because we gotta clear the air here. I'm not even usually a big Purell person. And we had a guest in here the other day and I realized that I've known this for a while, you've known this, the listeners have known this. When I laugh a lot, I blow my nose a lot. It's an uncommon thing. I don't know if anybody else has this, but it's a reality that I live with. And so when we have guests on the podcast, I find myself blowing my nose a lot in front of people who don't know me that well, which is a little embarrassing. And then I start thinking, when this person leaves, I'm going to go to shake their hand. And they're going to think, I've watched this slime ball blowing his nose for the past half hour to 60 minutes. And I don't want to touch his hand. So I thought, I was at the drugstore yesterday, and I thought I should buy a little bottle of Purell and keep it in my little desk drawer here. Now, I'm not even a big fan of Purell. I'd rather get up and just use the soap, my Mrs. Meyer's soap in the bathroom there. It has a great smell to it. But I bought this. And then while we were doing yesterday's show, I remembered, oh, the Purell is in my backpack. I should just pull it out and get it ready in case I need to shake Luke's hand or whatever. And
slime ball.
It was just sitting here on the desk, and it was an unopened thing of Purell. And I think I just, like, while you were talking, I mindlessly picked it up and just kind of, like, put it up to my nose to smell it a bit. I must have squeezed it a tiny bit or something.
It's easy
it did
to
kinda,
do.
Yeah, kind of just jumped up on my beard. And then, did you notice? I think it stuck to my beard for a while, for a you long had, time, and you didn't tell
you
me.
You had a significant portion of it in... The
How
part of your beard
that
would be actually a soul patch, you don't have a soul patch. You have a beard.
It was down here.
You have a very nice beard, but a section, a globule of Purell was residing in what would be the soul patch were you to shave everything except that section of facial hair.
How did you as a friend not tell me that? Because I noticed it
I just felt
much
that this was
later.
A personal thing you were dealing with.
It was... At least five, if not 10
you know
or 15
what?
Minutes
Honestly,
later.
Went through my mind was, I don't know, it's a cleansing agent. It'll evaporate. If it were pea soup, I would have told you.
But the whole time I was talking, it was just globbling there.
No, it was
the
absorbing into your beard
it was
and skin.
Oh, this
and,
is embarrassing.
And evaporating. No. It didn't look, honestly, if it looked silly, I would have told you. It didn't look silly for some reason. It's clear. You have a lot of facial hair.
I do have a lot of
facial
hair.
It actually wasn't distracting, and I forgot about it right after you did it.
How is Operation Beard Growth going, by the way? Probably not big enough for you to notice any difference.
No, yet. I can see the beginnings of it. So this
on the
is,
sides
hey,
here.
Can
it
I mention
to come out?
Too, by yeah. the way, that this is episode 2898 in a collector series.
Let the fun begin.
And that the very guest in question that I believe you were thinking of and referencing is somebody who knows all about the world of Jeopardy.
Never let me slip, because if I slip, then I'm slipping.
Jeopardy has been in the news a whole lot because of James Holzhauer, because of Alex Trebek. And it turns out we know somebody who's part of the TBTL universe who has a thing or two to say about Jeopardy, Mr. Ken Jennings himself.
Sometimes the smartest of us can be the most childish.
Even you?
No, not me.
It's an actual recording of Ken Jennings doing a Stephen Hawking impression mm-hmm. on The Simpsons. A lot of people don't know that.
Mm-hmm. And that the other voice is me.
Yep, that's true. Absolutely
true. I was
true.
Younger.
So before you started drinking all that Purell,
yeah.
that really ages the voice. So anyway, that's coming up as part of our Friday Friendo today. We're going to talk to Ken Jennings in just a few minutes. But yeah, I wasn't not telling you, Andrew, because it was embarrassing or weird. It was surprisingly not embarrassing and surprisingly not weird.
That's
now,
good.
Maybe that's because you and I have just spent so much time together
yeah.
at this point in
really
confined
have.
Spaces recording things for this show that almost nothing can rattle me anymore.
Wow.
That's
well,
not
that,
true. Anything can rattle me.
I was going
to
say, that gives me a lot of freedom.
Yeah. But not related to you, I should mention. Like nothing you can do rattles me. A bird flying by can rattle me.
Indicating the time of a show while you're hosting it can rattle you. I learned that.
In my earphones?
What's that?
What was it? Oh, because of me being surrounded by clocks.
Surrounded by clocks, right? I think I just pointed to my wrist.
Oh,
and
yeah.
you were just like, what's going on? Why are you pointing to your wrist? You were rattled.
I was already entering sleep deprivation at that point. Was that on the Vanniversary show?
That was the first episode, though.
Oh, I was shook. We talked about this.
I think you had a... Have we talked about it? I think you were really nervous going into that.
I was.
Yeah.
And I didn't even realize it until it started. Until it literally, it was like, well, this is happening.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was really nervous because I thought... Like, I honestly thought that show kind of got better. Those mm-hmm. shows got better as we went on.
Yeah.
But I think in our... this is apparently when we relitigate the Vanniversary shows. It's the TBTL Friday edition. Months and months, years later.
About a year and a half, almost exactly later.
It's been on the listener's mind.
Yeah.
So I think that I was really freaked out on that particular episode when we drove up to mm-hmm. Bellingham, because I think I thought, if this isn't going to work the way I hoped it was going to work,
mm-hmm.
we're fucked.
Right.
Like I think I was having a moment of panic because it was more work. The show was not as self-generating
mm-hmm.
as I expected it to be.
Mm-hmm.
I think my thought was, I don't know, we'll come out of the coast, have a few laughs.
Right.
Like, we'll get in this van, we'll turn on this machinery, and we'll start talking, and then it will just flow.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't flow as much or as easily as I thought it was going to, probably because of my
nerves.
But
I think your brain was locked up about it, yeah.
Yeah, and I was like, oh my God. We have to do this for 23
mm-hmm.
more hours.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, ultimately, we got loopy. We played a lot of American Pie. We got some great hop-ons.
We played some Trivial Pursuit at one point, going over the pass.
Everything worked out. God, I forgot that even happened. That is we always talk about this show being a blur. That 24 hours is an absolute blur.
You know, I think...
If you told me we hit a drifter... And had to bury them off the side of the road, and then I would be like, that's possible that happened.
You don't remember any of that. You're just making that example up out of whole cloth, and you're telling me you don't remember any of that.
Yes, and as far as the cops know, I wasn't there.
Sure. Okay. We'll go with your narrative. Yeah, I think that, and you know, maybe it's not fair. I don't know. I mean, it might be because, you know, you're sitting in the main seat, so, you know, maybe there's just more nerves with that. Maybe because I was working on the more technical back end with Corey about it. Maybe I just had more familiarity. I don't know what it was, but I remember being, like, when I kind of realized what was going on with you, and I was like, oh, yeah, I don't know. I just wasn't at... And also, I think you have a different relationship with sleep than I do. Like, the idea of staying up all night didn't really bother me. I'm like, yeah, we'll get loopy at some point. But I wasn't really worried about, like, nodding off or something, because I've pulled plenty of all-nighters before. And mm-hmm. so I remember being kind of like, oh, yeah, you're in your head about this.
Yes, I was.
Yeah.
Anyway, but good. The good news is what I'm not in my head about is this Today's conversation that we're about to have with Ken Jennings. Okay. Why? Because it already happened.
Yeah, and it was good.
And it was really good.
Yeah.
He's a delight as listeners to this show or listeners to his podcast with John Roderick, Omnibus knows, people who watch him on Jeopardy know. So that's what we have for you today, primarily. We're going to come back after our chat with Ken. We're going to do music for your weekend, of course, because it is a Friday. But we're going to do something, Andrew, right now that is probably unprecedented in the modern era of TBTL, or really any era. We are not only going to hit a break on time, we are going to hit it slightly early.
Well, unless I comment on that, and then it starts this whole thing.
Andrew, I'm surrounded by clocks and tension right
Why
now.
Why do you keep pointing to your wrist? You're exactly. not even wearing a watch.
Okay, you found the one thing that could rattle me. Let's take a quick break, and then we're going to come back. We'll talk to Ken Jennings, and then we'll do some music for your weekend. This is TBTL. Don't point at your wrist. Ken, welcome back to TBTL.
Well, it was a pleasure, Luke. Thanks for having me again.
So there's been two really big things happening in the Jeopardy-verse. One of them is Alex Trebek having pancreatic cancer, and the other is this guy, James Holzhauer, who has just been, like, poning the game, as none of the kids are saying. And what I realized as these two big news stories about Jeopardy have been kind of going on is that I feel like you are kind of the unofficial Jeopardy spokesperson in a way, whether you asked for that job or not. I don't know if it's because you're media savvy or because you have the record or just because you're very socially adjusted. Somehow you're just like the person that everyone's going to on these two topics. Is that fun for you, or are you a little tired of it?
Jeopardy was always my favorite show as a kid. So it's like it's the great honor of my life to be associated with my favorite show in some small way. But on the other hand, when something happens in, as you say, into the Jeopardy-verse, and I wake up and there's like six emails from six different CNN shows in my inbox being like, hey, Ken, you want to come on and talk to Lorenzo DeMaria, some host I've never heard of, about Jeopardy yeah. at 3 p.m.? This has literally happened to me six times a day. So being a goodwill ambassador yeah. for Jeopardy is a pleasure. But it's feast or famine for sure.
It's like you're on the throne and people are always coming after you, sort of. Like, and how much are you paying attention until these things kind of like pop up? Like, are you watching the show like kind of regularly anyway?
I cannot enjoy my favorite show the way I used to. Mm-hmm. Like, my kids will always want to have it on at home, but when I hear the music and when I hear Alex's clipped Canadian tones, like, I really do have like legit flashbacks. Like, nothing traumatic. Jeopardy's fun, but, like, my adrenaline spikes. It's game day. I can no longer just yell out answers from my couch
the way
the rest of America can. I feel like I'm on the clock when I hear the Jeopardy music.
Luke, that's like the theme songs for the shows we used to work on, like, individually, right? Like, there's a show that I worked on in New Hampshire where if that Grover Washington Jr. song comes on the radio, like, my heart starts beating really quickly because I'm like, is the ISDN working? Is our guest in the studio yet?
Yeah, I have been conditioned. Whenever I was... Like one of Pavlov's dogs.
Whenever I was in charge of a show, I would pick a theme song that was so obscure. By the way, most of the shows I work on get canceled because of this kind of decision making. But like, there's no chance of when they fight by the Generationals ever coming on in Natural Life,
yep.
which was the theme of the short-lived Luke Burbank hour of the middays on Kairo.
I guess the lesson is choose a song you hate, right?
Yeah.
Jeopardy theme's everywhere. Like, I can't watch a Major League Baseball pitching change, or I'll hear the Think music, and I get very nervous and angry.
Do the Jeopardy people ever call you up and say, like, hey, why did you say that about the show? Or these are the things we're trying to emphasize about this latest, Alex news or whatever. Like, are they in contact with you, or are you just, like, beyond the wall? In the wind, just saying whatever you want.
If I'm on the show, I am very much in the Jeopardy straitjacket because you sign away your life. There's all these federal laws regulating game show contestants. Jeopardy really owns your ass. But like once, if the story's not about me, I'm beyond the wall. I'm one of the free folk. Nobody at Jeopardy is like, we really want you to do Good Morning America, Ken. I did once get a talking to when I made some jokes about Jeopardy that the New York Post said was me biting the hand that feeds. I said that that Alex should be releasing swarms of bees of the contestants, and you know, I had all these terrible ideas for how to liven up the show.
Uh-huh.
And you know, a couple conservative news outlets were like, "This is very ungrateful of Ken to be criticizing Jeopardy at this point." And that's when I realized. And somebody at the show did say, "You know, Ken, it's a brand we have to safeguard. We take this very, very seriously." More than me, apparently.
Really?
Well,
but then they still like, but they always have to kind of at least while you're still the all time money champion, and I guess most episodes champion, they still have to like, they need some vitamin K in their life. Like they can't, that you couldn't piss them off enough that they'd be like, no more Ken Jennings, because you're the reigning king still.
It's a very weird dynamic where most contestants really do know that Jeopardy is holding all the purse strings. That's not an expression. Jeopardy has all the whole mm-hmm. cards, whatever the expression is.
I've collected all the purse strings.
As we
look
say.
At this collection of purse strings.
Whereas, you know, like somebody like me actually is in a situation where I could be like, actually, Jeopardy, what if maybe you need me as much as I need you? But it doesn't usually come to that because they have always been very, you know, generous and transparent with me.
So when something like this happens, though, and now, like, you know, this new guy, what's his name again? Luke, you just said it before. I've already forgotten.
Holtzauer.
He's, like, in the race, and I see that you guys are joking around on Twitter about it. Like, does that put you back in it? Like, whether or not it's fun or not, or whether or not your heart is racing on the couch? Like, do you feel like, okay, I got to start paying attention now?
It's not quite the same thing, but I do have to start paying attention. Like, the other day, I found myself looking at an online statistical comparison of me versus this guy game by game, something that I would have no interest in doing in the last 15 years. But now I'm just, you know, now that I've seen it, I'm just obsessed with it. I was like, whoa, I had 760 correct answers through game 22, and he's got 803. That's like 6% better, you know? So yeah, I am kind of watching my own obsolescence here in real time.
But for the people that haven't been following it, this guy, James Holtzauer, he's like a professional gambler and a really smart person, and what he's been doing is kind of playing with a new strategy, and he can really back it up by answering the questions right. What he does is starts out picking the most valuable questions he can so that if he hits a daily double, he's got as much money as possible to bet on it. And a lot of people say that he's like broken the game, or he's like disrespecting the way that Jeopardy is played. Is there a way that Jeopardy should be played, and is he playing it right or wrong?
All that stuff just makes me so glad that I was on Jeopardy in 2004 when social media was not yet the blight it is today, because nobody had to come up with 10 hot takes a day about me.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas this poor James guy, it's constantly like, has he broken Jeopardy? Has he ruined it for viewers? Is he ruining it for his contestants? Does he have unfair advantage? Like, the guy, as we all know, has one job on Jeopardy, and it's not to make good TV. He's trying to win games and win money, and he's doing it, and his reward is what? A dozen hot takes a day from, like, you know, idiots telling him he's playing wrong?
Is that going to get in your head, though? Because you'll be back on at some point, right? Champions Week or something?
They often have a thing every few years where they'll drag people out of, you know,
you were just
Captain
on this
America
like, team tournament.
Yeah, I was on just a couple of months ago, so I don't know how often they can go back to that. Well, it may be a while before everybody gets to see me and James or whoever.
But when you're up there now, like on the occasion that you do go do a guest spot, like is all of this new information in your head, or do you just dismiss it pretty quickly?
I'm definitely aware of the pressure of like now having an audience. Like playing Jeopardy in 2004 for me was just such a breeze. It was just like playing it on your couch, yelling on answers, and if I just, you know, kind of play comfortably and conservatively and do my thing, I'm going to win another week. Like, how long is this crazy ride going to last? And now every time I'm on the show, I feel like there's a huge target on my back.
Uh-huh.
And usually it's because that's true. There's a huge target on my back. People are like, well, I want to beat this guy. But maybe now James is the guy. Maybe I'm finally the gunslinger who gets beat and can sit in his rocking chair.
You're the Ballad of Buster Scruggs or something. I really like the social media interaction that you and Holtzauer have had going on, though. I saw a picture of you sitting on the beach. Like, you made a joke about how you were like, you know, if in like 50 episodes it was time to get worried or something. And then Holtzauer was like, kind of had a funny response. And then at some point, you guys were both just being like really funny and nice to each other. I think Holzhauer said, like, new to Twitter. Is this how beefs work?
Yes. It turned into one of the wholesome beefs very quickly, which is good. I think that's what Jeopardy fans want. Nobody wants Jeopardy fans to actually hate each other. I think they get uncomfortable even when the level of kayfabe, you know, gets anywhere close to pro wrestling and the contestants are actually being like, I'm coming for you, Jennings. I feel like Jeopardy fans are they're delicate orchids, you know? They don't want that. They want a nice, clean, you know, mutually respectful game. And so when James and I were fooling around on Twitter, I mean, he taped those shows months ago. He knows what's going to happen. When he says, ooh, Ken's in suspense for another few weeks, I mean, you know, he's doing a bit, and I'm happy to play along.
I got excited when you said kayfabe. I saw you looked at me. You said, like, my face lit up when you said kayfabe because I didn't know that word 3 days ago, and Luke just taught it to me on TBTL. So that's – if you're wondering what's going on with my face right now, that's it.
So much of society is now kayfabe-based. Everyone should now know this weird wrestling word.
Right. It's going to be, like, formally part of the 2020 presidential debates. There will be, like
– who will be the first president to say the word kayfabe?
You're right. I guess Holzhauer sort of knows the outcome because these things are taped fairly far in advance. But, like, are you genuinely, just really don't care about having the all-time record of the money that's won? I think right now it's like he said, like, he's behind you by, what, half a mil or something?
His money total? Like, the cash record is definitely way more in jeopardy, to coin a phrase, because he is, you know, I would play very conservatively and just, like, you know, I build up a lead slowly and then make sure I maintained it without making crazy bets that could risk the lead. Whereas this guy puts all his chips in early and often. And, you know, I was absolutely leaving money on the table. Like, he's making he's averaging 70 something thousand a game, which was the all time record when I set it. Like, the all time one game record when I set it. That's his average. So he really is just seeing a phenomenon that we have not seen before.
So he's going to the chances are pretty great that he'll get to the all-time money record. The question will be if he gets to the all-time episodes one record. I guess my question to you, Ken, is had this style of play occurred to you? Like, people that really know Jeopardy, like, do they all know about this already? Like, oh, you just get as much money as you can and you just really go for it on the daily doubles? Or did he really kind of sort of pioneer something?
He did. The thing I admire most about James or any player that comes in like that with a theory is that they have the confidence – to do that. It's enormously intimidating to walk out onto this TV set and have, you know, this game you've been watching your whole life surround you and suddenly be playing against real people for real money with real Alex. You know, it's a real crucible. People don't understand how stressful that is. And to be able to walk in there like him and be like, I've never done this before and no one's ever done this before, but I kind of have a theory and I'm going to play this weird way. I mean, you have to admire, like, the balls of it, you know, if nothing else. And that it never occurred to me. I was just going to play like I was on my couch. And it turned out I had a really good mojo with the buzzer, the little button. And I knew a lot of the answers and everything was going great. And I didn't want to jinx it. So I was just kind of riding it as long as it went. And I would get letters from poker players being like, Ken, you left so much money on the table. If you had bet 10,000 on that daily double instead of 3,000. And I would be like, who are these guys telling me how to play Jeopardy? But they're now
Jimmy Holzhauer, age 12.
Did you know that I actually did meet this guy in person? We met at Bumbershoot in 2012.
What?
And I had no memory of this. Yeah, I was moderating a trivia thing at Bumbershoot, and he's one of the finalists. And so three people come on stage, and I had totally forgotten this. He emailed me and said, hey, do you remember at Bumbershoot when you did that trivia thing and there was one guy at the end who kept buzzing in so fast, too early, getting everything wrong because he was like too quick? That was me. So he has he has come a long way in 7 years since you know, when he was the apprentice. He's the master now.
Is there like not to make too big of a deal out of this, but I mean, is there a being the all-time kind of considered to be the all-time Jeopardy champion, however that's defined? That's a really good brand for you. You have great books that you've put out and connections quiz, and you do all kind of Omnibus with John Roderick. You do a bunch of stuff. I'm sure Omnibus is the most financially profitable of all of your enterprises.
Like all podcasts.
Knowing what I know about, mm-hmm. about podcasting.
I am swimming around in a vault full of money like Scrooge McDuck as soon as I get done with this show.
And free Quip toothbrushes. That's really where you make the money. But like for you, you know, being known for being kind of like the best Jeopardy player of all time, that's a really good brand. Now, is being the second best Jeopardy player of all time as strong of a brand? Is this actually a financial threat to you?
We may find out. I never really thought about the value of the brand. Like, I was convinced I was not going to be famous for being on Jeopardy. Even when it was going on, I was like, America does not care who's on Jeopardy. If anything, they're going to get mad if it's the same guy for 6 months, you know? So I was as surprised as anybody when it turned into a thing. But at this point, I feel like in hindsight, it was kind of canny what I was doing, you know, putting out a book about Jeopardy and quiz culture, and then a book of trivia, and then a book about maps, which is nerdy but a little further afield, and then a book kind of debunking parenting myths, which is, again, kind of a facty thing, but even further afield. And I just put out a book on comedy, and that's kind of the biggest stretch of all.
A really good book on comedy, by the way.
So, like, in hindsight, well, it kind of seems like the brand is just kind of like guy who's interested in a lot of stuff. And
sure.
And honestly, like, having been first to the poll, like being kind of the first, you know, guy that people remember for being on Jeopardy for a while, it turned out that was just worth its weight in Casper mattresses and Quip toothbrushes. So I feel like it's always going to be Ken. Oh, and then there was that new guy, you know, like I feel like he could break every record and it's still going to be like, there were those two guys and they were kind of different.
I realize that the name recognition gives you a huge leg up when it comes to book sales, especially for your early books. But like, is this the life you'd be living anyway? Like, would you be writing these books anyway?
Absolutely not. Like the best thing Jeopardy did for me was not the money or anything. It was really just like, you're...
Can I have the money then?
Yes. It wasn't a big deal. I guess what I'm saying is I want Luke to have the money.
Okay.
It's like, it's the confidence that comes with like, hey, you're one of the best people at this thing. And if you didn't like your computer science job, why are you not doing something you're actually good at, Ken Jennings? Which was true. I was in a programming job I didn't like, and I was always kind of complaining to my wife and telling her, you know, all these like, weird ideas. What if I went to law school? I was really desperate then, and my midlife crisis was instead winning on a game show for 6 months, and that turned out great. So being a writer is something I'd never thought I could make a living at. And even now, maybe I can't, but it's a lot closer than I would have been. And I'm a freelancer, so I'm home when my kids come home from school. I'm a better dad. I mean, the whole lifestyle changed with Jeopardy. I guess what I'm saying is if you can arrange to go on Jeopardy 75 times, you should totally do it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. You were talking about like social media and your sort of 15 minutes. I saw somebody was like, your 15 minutes are up. And you, I thought, quite drolly said, I think it's been like 15 years. It's a pretty good run. And then I went, Ken, because I'm very protective. I don't know if you consider us friends, but I consider us friends. I'm
absolutely
very protective,
Luke,
of my friends. I went and was like, who the F is this guy? And I went and looked at his Twitter feed. Of course, total MAGA head. Are those the people that like are usually coming after you on Twitter?
I don't usually Twitter shame people. That's bad form when you have a bigger pulpit than they do. But once I saw that Brett Kavanaugh was his Twitter banner, I was like, yes, all bets are off with this guy.
And his specific, his smaller avatar, whatever you call that smaller photo, is like an extremely terrible picture of Ruth Bader Ginsburg making her look like she's evil. Oh, I was like, God. Give me a break.
Yeah, but I do get that kind of thing remotely. Like anytime I say anything political, it's like, you know, it's the comedian getting told stick to the jokes, funny guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Except in this case, it's like your 15 minutes are up, Jeopardy guy.
Stick to knowing things. Oh wait, that doesn't work.
Don't. Which fair enough. Honestly, the right wing reply is usually yet again another starry eyed liberal who's, you know, knows these facts, but not, you know, street smarts.
Yeah,
you know, like,
right.
Not the wisdom that we on our side of the aisle have. So there's no
raised in that
it.
Classic lefty commune culture of Mormonism,
Mormon Utah,
right?
And the intellectual,
just another out of touch coastal, the coast of the Great Salt Lake,
yes.
Just coastal elite,
and the liberal hotbed of Jeopardy, watched by
right.
you know. you know, nice kids on the spectrum and then like 83-year-old women from the Midwest. And, you know, that's Jeopardy for you.
That's another thing that they're going to ask you to not say in your Washington Post interviews, by the way, or your New York Post interviews.
I make jokes about the Jeopardy demographic all the time, and nobody has ever gotten mad at me, and they must just be like, no, that's on us. We're the ones putting the denture adhesive ads on during the first commercial break. You can't tell us anything about our demographic we do not already know.
I noticed that when the news came out about Alex Trebek being ill, you wrote a piece, I think, in the New York Times, like an op-ed piece, which I thought was very well structured, because I think you said very early in the piece, this is not a memorial. I'm not here. I'm not eulogizing him. This is just sort of saying this is the Alex Trebek that I have had experience with. And this is kind of my insight into this guy. What is it about – what were you trying to say with that piece, and what is it that you have kind of observed about him that the, I guess, wider world might not quite get?
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure it was like, let's appreciate this guy while we have him. And I didn't want it to look like I was trying to cash in on Alex's cancer diagnosis by placing an article. Like, they called me and they said, do you want to write about Alex this weekend? And I was like, well, no. I mean, I'm sad about Alex. But the more I thought about it, I realized people don't get him. They don't get what a hard job he is doing every night, running that show for the three contestants and the audience at once. I mean, he's a real broadcaster to be able to do what he does. You've hosted quiz shows before, Luke. You know what I'm talking about. It's tough work, right?
I can't even I can barely host pub trivia, honestly. Like, you know what? I have to say, Ken, like, in that piece that you wrote, it had never quite occurred to me the plates that guy's got to spin. And you said they tape, like, how many shows in a day?
They do 5 in a day. They do a full week in a day. Wow. So he's trying to get in it's 61 clues in 20 minutes or so, plus denture adhesive ads. And and so, you know, when he seems a little brisk or short, it's not because he's cranky. He's not putting on airs when he pronounces something right. He's not being smug when he corrects somebody. Like, he is doing the job that he has done every weeknight for 35 years. And let's salute that, damn it.
And it seems like on the show, and, you know, we're guilty of this too. We like to have fun with his manner. And he can seem like so non-self-aware. But then when you see him in other contexts, Luke and I were both struck by how self-aware he seems to be. Luke, fill in the details on this. He was moderating that debate, and I believe that was in maybe upstate New York. Am I right about that?
It was a Pennsylvania gubernatorial debate. You know about this, Ken?
Yeah.
You must have seen this.
Yeah. And, you know, it didn't go over super well, but in the interview afterwards, he just seemed so damn relatable. He seemed like exactly the guy that I would want to be after something like that, saying, you know, I tried it, they didn't like it, whatever. And he just seemed really self-aware.
Yeah, I actually said that in the New York Times. Like, maybe I'm the first person to say, like, Alex Trebek knows he's a comic signifier, and he is in on the joke. I don't know if people get that about him. Like, when he takes off the suit, you know, you'll just see him backstage, and he'll just be in dad jeans and a bomber jacket and a baseball cap, and he will be on his way home to clean the pool or fix a shingle or something. Like, he's a do-it-yourselfer, so he'll be driving home in his Dodge Ram to his place in the valley to hang crown molding or something. Like, he is very much not the starchy kind of, private school, upper class elite guy he appears on the show. He's he's an immigrant French Ukrainian kid from working class Ontario. And that's who he really is.
Not to in any way try to turn this into one of those BS, like, everything happens for a reason. But I will say that an emerging plot line from him being sick is he's had a chance to kind of show how funny he is. Like, he just this week, I think, won an Emmy for host, like a daytime Emmy for best, a game show host.
Yeah.
And the speech, I'll just paraphrase it here. I don't know if you saw this yet, Ken. It's pretty funny. He goes up and he's like, basically he says, I won this. Everyone's super, like, you know, cheering and teary eyed because, like, he's, you know, he's got this real grim diagnosis. And he says something like, I was wondering if I was going to get a sympathy vote this year. And I don't like sympathy votes. But he goes, but then last year I had like two really intense health scares, like a blood clot on the brain or something. Like,
yeah.
And I was up for this award and I didn't win. So clearly sympathy was not on my side then. So maybe I'm overthinking this. He delivered it in a much funnier Alex Trebek way. But it really, like, was – there, he just had it, like, when he did the video about the diagnosis, he said, like, I have to live because I've got a 3-year contract. Like, it's been kind of fun to get to see little glimmers of this guy being funny, actually.
His comic timing is excellent. During commercial breaks on the show, he will always do Q&A with the audience. And, of course, they're asking the same 10 questions over and over. So he has these answers down to a T. You know, people will ask him, if you weren't a game show host, what would you be? And he'll always say, I always wanted to be Pope. So he actually is naturally funny. You don't get to see it on the show. And he knows what he means to people for sure. Like the kind of matter-of-fact way he told everybody he had a very dire cancer prognosis, just in the same way he would read a Daily Double clue or something. You know?
Yeah.
He knows America relies on him because people invite him over every night for half an hour. And there's not a broadcaster like that anymore that we do that with. He's kind of the last of those Walter Cronkite or Johnny Carson types that you feel like is part of your family. And he's really heard from a lot of people. You know, he's gotten hundreds of thousands of messages. People are sending him religious relics and holy water and whatnot. And
oh man.
And he said to me, like, most people don't get to hear what they mean to people. Like, most people are gone before this happens. And I actually got to see it. He feels lucky. He feels blessed.
I don't want to, if I'm not asking you to share anything private, Ken, or, you know, whatever, maybe you don't have an answer to this, but I'm just curious, like, if you've talked to him since the diagnosis, like, in person, like, without cameras around, he seems pretty upbeat, you know, when he's you know, recording videos to announce it and all that, and he's keeping up a brave face, but, like, how did he seem when you talked to him, if you don't mind talking about that?
He can turn on Alex Trebek, for sure, you know, at the Jeopardy team thing in the spring. It was before he had the diagnosis, but he was still really run down backstage. He was not feeling good. He might have just had a cold or the flu, or it might have been, you know, early signs. But as soon as the show started, he could go right out there and turn it on. And I think the chemo has taken a lot out of him. He's tired. He's but people get foggy brains from that stuff, and he can still go out and do this enormously hard job. The taping I saw him at, he realized he had made a mistake. He had given somebody credit for saying, what is if, when the answer was, what are ifs, like ifs, ands, and buts. And normally you can get away with that on Jeopardy. But in this case, it was like 3-letter words. So he realized. So without ever being told by anybody, at the next stoppage of play, somebody had a Daily Double, and he's like, but before we get to that, and he's just winging this, I have a change in scoring to announce. Mary on the end has said ifs, and if I recall correctly, she said if, and that's did not meet the category, 3-letter words. So we're going to have to change her score. We're going to take away the 400 we gave her and another 400, so that'll drop you down to 1800. And he's just doing all this in his head.
Jeez.
Through chemo brain and whatever kind of personal pain he's in. And he's just still the best.
Wow, I didn't realize that. I assume that those decisions are always coming in from judges, and sometimes they must be, right?
That's what surprised me. Like, the judges were already, the phone had lifted. I could see the judges talking about it, and I knew the next break they were going to announce a change of scoring. And instead, before, Alex just called an audible and did it before they even came back from the break.
And did he kind of need to do it in that moment because it would have been money that she could have bet with?
I think it was a Daily Double, and he had to announce a scoring change just because you want to know what everybody's scores are before you make the wager. That's a guy who understands the game. 35 years. It's in his blood.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, I don't want to, hopefully he will be in the very, statistical minority of people who somehow manage to live a long time and beat something like this, or at least survive with it. But do you, you must get asked this a lot too, but I mean, can Jeopardy exist without Alex Trebek?
That is the existential question of Jeopardy. And it's not just his cancer diagnosis. This has been the existential dilemma for Jeopardy every time his contract has come up for the last 10 to 20 years. Because they have a very change-averse audience. That team thing I did, it fiddled with the Jeopardy format a little in that there was a draft, captains drafted teams.
I remember.
People swapped players in and out at the commercial breaks.
Oh.
So there was a lot of kind of logistics to run. And so they would split shows into 2 days in order to, with 3-man teams, 3-person teams, you got to do 3 times the contestant interviews. The only way to do it was to split shows into 2 games. 2 days, and people were coming unglued. They were like, it's 7:18 and they haven't started the Double Jeopardy round yet. What is happening in America?
I was one of those people before I figured out what the format was. I was like, how are they going to land this?
Is there not going to be
making any sense to me?
Is there not going to be Wheel of Fortune tonight? Like people right. were freaking out. And so Jeopardy knows, like, this is what they're going to have to deal with whenever, for whatever reason, Alex decides to call it a day. And it's going to be one of the most tricky recastings. And this is not Aunt Viv on Fresh Prince. This is going to be a very tricky a very tricky recasting for them. They can't just not acknowledge it. What do you do there? It's going to be tough on their audience.
Although you bring up a good point. What is the original Aunt Viv doing? Maybe she's the perfect solution.
Yes. I feel like a really good, an optimal version of this, I think, was like Drew Carey replacing Bob Barker on The Price is Right. Now, they're very different kinds of shows, but Bob Barker was so like just seemed – by the way, Ken, Bob Barker born where?
Bob Barker born in – wow, I used to know this. Is it the Midwest? Where is it?
Deming, Washington.
Oh, wow. Deming. That's awesome.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Maybe. Let's double. Can we get the judges to look that up during the break? We may need a score revision after this. He definitely lived in Deming for a while, I think. Anyway, up that way. Bob Barker, when he left The Price is Right, to me it was like The Price is Right was Bob Barker with that wand microphone putting a golf ball. And then when Drew Carey took it over, I actually think Drew Carey's really good at the job. I don't watch the show on a regular basis, but I don't think the show suffered. I think it's still a really fun show to watch for all those reasons. Now, Jeopardy is a different kind of program. But I guess my question is, I wonder if they want to go in the direction of somebody who is, you know, pretty straight-laced appearing the way that Alex Trebek is, or if they want to go with someone who's more, like, relevant. It feels to me like if they try to go relevant – like, I rarely argue for this, but I'm arguing for the conservative choice. They almost need it to be somebody who isn't trying to bring too much pizzazz. I feel like too much pizzazz from the host position of Jeopardy would throw the whole mix off.
That's always been Alex's position, which is that, you know, like, Art Fleming in the 60s was always announced as the star of Jeopardy. And Alex is never – he's always the host of Jeopardy. Mm. And that's because he feels like the star is the game. Like, he's just facilitating – the actual appeal of Jeopardy, which is the contestants and the answers and the questions. So I think you're right. Like it's the kind of show you cannot recast with a comedian, which is the trend today, because there's just no time for it and it throws off the focus.
What
of
about
the show.
A person who recently wrote a great book about comedy?
I get asked this a lot. Like people are under the impression that Jeopardy is some kind of Willy Wonka setup where Alex has just been looking for the right special little boy.
Like the last starfighter.
To take over his factory. Exactly. Right. You did it, Ken.
Yeah, glass elevator.
Hop in the elevator. You're now the host of Jeopardy. And no, I don't believe that's how the show. I mean, I would do that job in a heartbeat. What a great gig. But no, I do not think that's what the show is going to be going for. Like every broadcaster wants this job, so it's going to be a crazy.
Right.
It's going to be a crazy scrum for whoever is tactless enough to be the first one to be like, okay, I know Alex is still fighting cancer, but. I'm going to have my agent call Sony.
Right.
Well, that's rough because exactly. He announced, you know, a couple of times over the past couple of years that his retirement is imminent, and that was before the diagnosis. So it's not unfair if you're somebody who's jockeying for that position to be, you know, proactive about it. But then when you throw in the sickness, it does add a wrinkle.
A lot of those people who used to tweet about how much they wanted the job are probably...
Lying low.
Back a little.
Yeah.
Like, I know Andy Richter, great celebrity Jeopardy player. He would love that job. LeVar Burton has lobbied for it on Jeopardy.
He'd be good. Andy Richter, I've never even thought of that. But, like, I think Andy has he's just got the right droll tone and kind of, you know, is just... Didn't we have you and Andy on Livewire and we made you guys eat fancy food and he called... either he or you called some hard-boiled eggs you're eating a plate full of farts or something. That was wonderful.
I think that was Andy. The question with somebody like that is, can they get away with after 35 years of having a white guy do it, can you just hire another white guy? Like,
yeah.
And there's a pretty good case for no. Like, now's not the time for that to be the face of Jeopardy again.
Yeah.
Because that's something they've dealt with on the contestant side, too, like trying to make sure the show looks more like America. What can we do to get more women trying out? Let's get more contestants of color on this show. And, yeah, I really don't know if they can just have year 30 whatever be another here's another white guy for 35 right. years.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of contestants on the show, we actually have a listener to TBTL who his name is Joe. He lives in Paulsbo. He's a special ed teacher, and he's on the teachers tournament right now, and he actually won this week his game, so he'll be back early next week. I think he's back on like Monday night. He's going to the next round or something. Now, I guess maybe he's already taped it, so this is sort of pointless, but I was going to say, do you have any advice? But is that meaningless? Because like if does that it's has it is it already in the can as
you,
far as you,
you
understand?
You want kayfabe advice?
No, I don't. You know what? I hadn't even thought until I posed the question. Until you mentioned Holzhauer having already taped a bunch of shows, it didn't even occur. The kayfabe is so strong on me, like it works so well that it didn't even occur to me that listener Joe's not going flying from Paulsbo to Culver City, California on Monday to be on Jeopardy. Like literally that hadn't occurred to me until I started asking this question.
You know what the secret is? You know how they hypnotize you with the kayfabe? Everybody changes clothes. As soon as you win on Jeopardy, yeah. You run backstage, you put on a new jacket and tie, and you come back out, and Alex, wow. And Alex is like, on yesterday's program, and it wasn't yesterday, it was 6 minutes ago.
Wow.
But that's how they trick you, Luke.
Nothing's wow. real. But nothing's so, real.
Well, then don't dispense any kayfabe advice. We can just. I also good job, listener Joe, for winning yeah. on Jeopardy.
I just want to congratulate him because like getting on that show is just they have hundreds of thousands of people trying out. Yeah. Like, good for him. Win or
well,
lose.
Let's be honest. He's a special ed teacher, so he's been kind of. I mean, his whole life has been a setup for this. You're going to not let the special ed teacher on Jeopardy?
But the thing is, it's not like Price is Right where you can just put anybody with a cute story on or anybody who shows up in a service uniform or an Alex right. Trebek t-shirt. Like, the show doesn't work.
Right.
Like, obviously, you've right. got to be an incredibly smart guy. And then they're hoping you have a decent story and don't. Pee the bed when you're on camera.
Yeah, you said before, I mean, of course, this is obvious, but you said that, you know, everybody thinks that they could go on that show and do it. And like, I'm not like that because I'm terrible in my living room. like the idea of being on a show like that just terrifies me. During TBTL, like I can't, like the moment I try to remember a celebrity's name, my brain locks up and I panic. But of course, like most people are at home. They're like, oh yeah, I got most of that category. I could do that. Like no problem. People aren't making the connection of what it must be like to be trying to do that on such a grand stage.
It's very intense on the show. It is a very different. It's like when you're, you know, in Tron, when you suddenly get zapped into the game right. grid and you're right. in the light cycle or whatever, right. and suddenly you're like, what is happening? It doesn't matter how good you were at Space Paranoids in the arcade. Like, it's a little different when stuff's actually blowing up all around you.
I think about something they say in like football interviews all the time. Athlete interviews are not my favorite kind of radio, but one thing that they say often is like the game slows down. Like by year two or three, the younger players will say the game slows down. I think that's a very interesting way of putting it because I understand that. I mean, honestly, just from playing stupid video games, like almost a sensation of like this game used to be overwhelming to me. There was so much going on, but then with just enough repetition, everything sort of slows down. Your adrenaline slows down and it doesn't seem so foreign anymore.
That's why I thought another long streak would be possible on Jeopardy. I'm like, the longer you're there, the more comfortable you get. Like my first show, I was so panicky that you're absolutely right. It seemed like it went by in like 5 minutes. I could not believe because I was just on autopilot and muscle memory, basically. Uh-huh. It's so stressful. But I believe the longer you're on that show, you're going to hit a plateau where you're indestructible. And in 15 years, I was thinking, I guess nobody's ever got to whatever that mm-hmm. plateau is because nobody can beat like 20 or 21 games. And I think we finally got the guy who is going to hit that plateau.
But I wonder also if – I mean, yes, but his – he, you know, he's betting big and he can back it up by getting things right. But I mean, he also with this strategy, it seems to me like it's he could be beatable, right? More so than somebody who's playing a more conservative strategy. He is getting $77,000 a show on average or whatever it is. But like also he could go big on a daily double and then not get it right. So, I mean, that seems like it's also possible that he could flame out to a relatively average player.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I was playing kind of my low-impact, low-stakes game, because I just wanted to be there the next day. I wanted to make that streak last. And it's true that there's if you're mm-hmm. making bigger wagers, there's more downside. And the game I eventually lost was just two daily doubles in a row that I straight up didn't know. I mean, to this day, I will never forget Bastogne and cloche hats. Because if I had known either of those, I would still be on Jeopardy today, 15 years later. in game, like, 1500 or whatever.
The most hated man in America.
You just have a beard like Tom Hanks in Castaway. You haven't been able to leave the stage. Wait, what was the cloche hat question? TBTL has actually been obsessed with the topic of cloches at various points in the show's history.
I wish you had been obsessed with cloches in, you know, summer 2004. Somehow, through the miracle of time travel, because it was just the easiest possible clue. You know, this dome shaped hat comes from the French for bell or something, and I did not know the French for bell. And so
I wouldn't have known that either, because a cloche is also that's the name, the name for that kind of what we think of as a fancy silver thing that goes over fancy food,
like on room service.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes,
so he's going to hit a game like that where he doesn't know a daily double or two, and it's going to be touch and go. But for me, it was game 75. Maybe for him, it's going to be game 175.
Yeah. Can I ask one last quick Jeopardy question, and then I'm going to talk about Omnibus. Like, this is the thing I don't understand, is hunting for daily doubles. Mm. Aren't you, at any point you're selecting any question on the board, hunting for a daily double? Like, how is there a way of – when they talk about Holzhauer and the sort of new generation of players, and they talk about how they hunt for daily doubles, how is that any different than just picking any random question on the board?
Luke, you have so much to learn.
Okay.
So there is – when I was on the show in 2004, like, there really were no Jeopardy saber metrics. There were not people analyzing thousands of games, you know, drilling themselves with thousands of clues, analyzing thousands of games, crunching big data to try to game the game. But now there is a database of hundreds of thousands of Jeopardy clues that a James Holzhauer type will just relentlessly drill himself on before he goes on the show. And there is data on daily doubles. They are not distributed randomly on the board. Even the layperson may notice they are almost never in the top row, for example.
Sure.
But it's more to it than that. Because they are placed by a human before the game, like a human actually looks at the board and says, oh, this clue and that clue, trying to pick a likely clue that would make for a good daily double with a moment's thought and a suspenseful pause. And because it's a human doing it, it's very non-random. And so patterns show up, not just top to bottom, although that's very noticeable that it's going to be more likely to be a 600 or an 800, you know, the third or the fourth row. But also, there's a bell curve, a cloche curve, if you will.
oh, God.
But also,
where was that 15 years ago?
I'm still bitter. But also left to right on the board. Like, there are vertical columns that are more likely to have daily doubles than others. And those change over time pretty markedly. But, you know, somebody who's got the data, it's like Ichiro coming up to the plate and he knows this guy is going to be throwing low and outside if it gets to 2-2 or whatever, you know? So there is that level of thinking for some of these people who go on the show.
Wow.
Which is nuts.
Do they rotate the person on the staff who picks the daily doubles? I feel like I could see a world where there's like a guy who's going through a bitter divorce, and if you look at the daily doubles over the course of a month, they spell, I hate Sharon.
This woman slept with her husband's best friend in 1998.
I did notice they are starting to slip stuff into clues. Like, Jeopardy is relentlessly apolitical, but in one of those Team Jeopardy shows, there was a clue that was about trying to come up with new electric vehicles that'll banish the internal combustion engine. And instead of banish the internal combustion engine, what the clue said was abolish ICE.
So, oh, no.
Like ICE. So the words abolish ICE appeared in a Jeopardy clue, have been spoken by Alex Trebek. And I don't know if anybody noticed, but maybe America got like 0.1% more woke in that
oh
second.
My God. That's incredible.
That all these
That's
old people
so interesting
heard
that they would...
Alex Trebek say abolish ICE.
And they're just thinking internal combustion engines, maybe, at least some of them.
Somebody is sneaking something into a clue there, for sure.
Yes, that's a not on accident at all.
Right. Wow.
But that's fascinating. Oh, wow.
The QAnon people need to start looking at Jeopardy clues for secret messages. That's what I'm saying, I think.
I've lost actual writer friends to QAnon. And it's like, oh, my God. I don't want to get into that. Let's get into Omnibus, your podcast that you and John Roderick do. I love this show. I'm always curious about the creation of the topics because you guys cover such a wide variety of interesting things. And it's, you know, you are two very smart people, but you guys are really taking on some pretty big projects with these. How do you guys – well, first of all, for people that haven't heard it, can you kind of explain the premise?
It's just one of these two gabby guys yak about little-known fun stuff
no
from,
future in
from
that.
History. And no? That's,
oh, that sounds great. Are they both white?
I finally found one where they're both white. They're male and wait for it, they're middle-aged.
Oh, perfect.
So,
oh.
Ladies, check it out. But the conceit of the show, insofar as there is one, is that we are trying to catalog all of these amazing stories for a distant future post-human audience that is not aware of Milli Vanilli or the Charge of the Light Brigade or whatever it is. So we have to explain these things to you know, jellyfish creatures or super intelligent coral reefs or whoever is around in 5,000 years.
Right, but we have, like, on this show, we have a term called sharpshooting from the audience where we, you know, we get things wrong constantly. And we're not even setting out to really inform people on a specific topic like Ted Danson in blackface or, you know, like cocaine hippos or something. So are you guys, like, when you're just kind of – you do a certain amount of research, but when you're just free associating, are people emailing you all the time, correcting you and, like, getting mad at you about – because we get a lot of pushback when we screw things up, which is constant, and we're not even trying to really talk about real factual events.
We do. We try to do our research, you know, because both of us, you know, as you say, if we have a brand, it's that we both think we're smarty pantses, and the show doesn't work without that. Mm. Like, it's not a show where, I mean, kind of one, in each show, one of us is kind of the storyteller, and the other person is kind of the layperson. But if either of us is, you know, makes an awful mistake, it's not great for the show, and we're totally living in the age of the actually, where we know we're going to hear about it. And if we catch ourselves, it's not a live show, so we can go back and John will be like, can we get rid of the part where I say that Calvin Coolidge came before Warren G. Harding or, you know, or whatever it is?
Yeah.
But honestly, I think too often we make the mistake of, I mean, it's okay to not enjoy being actual lead, but I don't think people are generally mad at us. Like, we have the kind of trivia geek audience that is just bursting to share something they knew.
Sure.
And maybe that's maybe there's a smug level of wanting to feel good and best somebody. But at the root of it, they just had something in their head that actually came in handy and they are excited about that. And I'm okay with that. I think it's key not to bristle at that kind of thing.
Yeah, I absolutely used the wrong term when I said mad, because that you're right. That's also the spirit in which, generally speaking, not always, but generally speaking, our listeners kind of correct us or clarify things. It's almost always just in, like, oh, you might not have seen this, or they're excited about, they have something to contribute to the show. I read it as they're mad at me because I'm that fragile. Any clarification or correction feels like a direct assault on really my sexual performance, but I know what you mean.
That escalated quickly. Well, they also always say that they threw their phone.
Well,
that's
it always
the other
does,
phrase,
Andrew,
right?
Despite what you may have heard.
I don't believe that anyone actually spit out water when I made a joke on my podcast, and I don't believe they threw their phone when I was factually wrong for a second on my podcast. Right. Unless I see tape of this, I'm not going
to
believe it.
The frustration, though, is real. I mean, there are times I'm listening to a podcast, and Ken, you don't know me. I don't know anything. Like, I have, like, two facts bouncing
That's
around
not true.
This head of mine.
He knows stuff, but he's so worried about not being able to pull it from whatever part of his brain it's in that almost, like, releases a massive dose of whatever chemical makes you not remember things.
Yeah.
But Andrew knows things. I don't want to let him misrepresent himself.
Okay.
That way.
I have lockjaw of the brain. But even myself, when I'm, like, you know, puttering around the house listening to a podcast and somebody can't, you know, come up with a name or a word, like, it is this weird frustrating thing. And somebody tweeted, Luke, about, like, that's the closest feeling you can have of being a ghost is when you're yelling at the people on the podcast because they can't hear you and you know the information. You, as a podcast listener, I assume you listen to some podcasts.
Sure.
You have a lot of information in your head. How often are you throwing phones or spitting water?
I have seen that ghost tweet, and that is exactly how it feels. But if you're me, this is your entire life. It's not just on podcast.
It's a conversation.
Yeah.
It's having coffee.
Five times a minute, I'm like, I don't think that's right. No, that's not actually true. But I feel like I have been so...
Do you think Vince McMahon from the World Wrestling Organization really shit his pants trying to do a joke fart and then had to shoot a promo and they had to only film him from the waist up? This has been a recent topic on TBTL. And we were debating the veracity of that story.
I don't know enough to... I want to believe that story. Let's put it that way. I would love to live in a universe where that story is true, for sure.
Okay. I'm sorry. I interrupted you, Ken.
Oh, I was just going to say, like, I've always been like you, Luke. I'm hyper aware of, well, maybe it's the opposite of what you said. I'm like hyper aware of not wanting to look like some trivia know-it-all, because often that was the thing that like separated me from my peers. Mm-hmm. So like my whole life growing up was like learning to kind of keep that under a bushel, because nobody likes to be corrected. Nobody likes the guy with the little extra bonus fact after every sentence. And if you have that in you, it's kind of a good social skill to like learn to dial it back. So to this day, I really do. I mean, I don't like the kind of mind that has to get that out there. You know, like, I don't think that's a very, I don't think it's a great look.
Mm-hmm.
But that said, you know, when people, you know, kind of delightedly say, oh, I was hoping they were going to mention the molasses flood when they were talking about the Johnstown flood. Like, absolutely. Go with God. Let's talk about the molasses flood.
Yeah. I everything you said, Ken, I agree with. I think I can't always successfully win. I'm nowhere near as knowledgeable as you are. I don't have as many facts in my brain. I did know where Bob Barker was born, so I think that's kind of point Burbank.
Clearly,
but
you have one more fact.
Here's my bell, by the way, if you want to go mano a mano with bell knowledge with Luke, feel free.
Tell you what, I've got two bells back here, so you better really be careful. An antique bell that my in-laws gave me for my birthday recently, and then the bell that I bought at a local paper goods store here in Bellingham called Bison. Anyway, I think because I don't actually know that much, when I do know something, I have a very difficult time keeping my light, you know, under that bushel, keeping my sugar on that shelf. And probably for somebody like you who's just spent a lot of time just knowing things, you have kind of had to figure out a system for that earlier on in life and have pretty much stuck to it. And I admire that and I salute you for that. I wish I was better at that.
I don't think I am always the poster child for not being a smarty pants, but it's really the kind of thing where if I dial it back, at least it won't be at 11 all the time.
Mm. Mm-hmm. I will say though, you were as we would be as well. You were pretty, I don't know, somewhat dismissive about your own podcast. I just want to say it's really good. And I'm not just saying that because you're sitting here. I've talked to other people about it behind your back as well. Like, Omnibus is not two guys. It does not sound like you're shooting from the hip. You guys have the perfect amount. You have the perfect rapport. It's I think the first one I heard. Now, let me see if I can pull the name. Who's the is it Mary Baker Eddy?
The Christian Scientist?
Yeah, the Christian Scientist one, which was just like you took this – you looked at the background of the founder of Christian Science and were able to just like kind of use it as a jumping off point for so many other things. And that sticks with me because it was the first one I heard. It's really good. People should check it out.
Thank you. I'm glad – I didn't want to do the hard plug, so I'm glad you guys were here to get down there in the trenches.
It's sincere.
We love the show.
No, it's
like,
good.
We feel like we're doing good work. And we get really into this stuff. You know, we were talking about – that whole episode was just to explain Christian Science reading rooms, which
mm-hmm. Oh, that's right.
Which,
yeah.
Why are they here? This one right here on the Ave. Like, what's mm-hmm. it doing there? I've never seen anyone in
yes.
there.
Yes, yes.
They always have really like primo real estate.
I know.
And it's just kind of like a big, like it's carved out of one piece of like granite or marble. It's always like a very, or a lot of times I've seen it as a very like kind of big grand structure. It's like, where's the money for that coming from?
This is the first thing I've done with all the books and TV and whatever, where like it's actually created kind of a little subculture like you guys have on TBTL, where people will now send us photos of a Christian Science reading room every time they see one.
Mm-hmm.
We did a show about mail trucks and now we have all these people obsessed with US mail trucks. So it kind of creates this whole little world, you know, and now there's a Omnibus verse as well as a Jeopardy verse. And I'm very flattered because I like the show a lot and it really does. It's still fun, lo these many years later.
Well, that's what I'm wondering because you also put something on social media recently and it looks like it was a text conversation between you and Roderick trying to come up with like basically show topics.
Yes.
And I saw that and I just thought like that's my idea of hell. Like just trying to be like, well, what haven't we talked about yet? Like there's the ones that just naturally spring up and you're like, oh, that'd be great. And then there's all of the slogging of like, well, what should we talk about this week?
He was like the number 14 ants.
Yes.
Frozen water. I think my approach has always been, if we keep doing the show for a long time, we're just going to have to do everything. That's the conceit of the show. We're making a time capsule,
yes.
So everything goes in. So you can't agonize every week on, should I do Mary Baker Eddy or should we do the, you know, the four-dimensional shapes or whatever, you know? Like, it's got to be everything. If you're going to do Doritos this week, fine, do Doritos. Mm-hmm. I think John has been a little more nervous about running out of stuff. So I sent him the whole list I had, which is reader submissions. You got to leverage listener submissions.
Oh, are you kidding me? This show is basically just, it's all crowdsourced, our show. It's exactly. Just generally reading mm-hmm. things the listeners sent in or talking about their appearances on Jeopardy. It's mostly what we have. Yeah, right.
People feel so flattered and they don't know how happy you are to just get somebody saying like, hey, you should do Centralia, Pennsylvania. Yes. Okay, fine. Mm-hmm. We'll do Centralia, Pennsylvania. Perfect. The Wiki, what are they called? The Waka Wiki Mermaids? Those Florida women in the 20s that wore mermaid outfits? Somebody suggested that to me the other day, and I was like, perfect.
My wife is going to Montana this weekend, and she's landing in Great Falls, and she said there's a restaurant there that promises – it's a restaurant in Great Falls that has mermaids like in a tank, and they promise a minimum of one mer person. I don't know if it's a merman or mermaid, but if you go eat there, it's like a steakhouse. There will be at least one person floating in a tank, presumably breathing out of an air hose of some kind, in Great Falls, Montana.
Yeah, I have a question at this point. Why landlocked Montana?
I don't know. That's what's so great about it. It is the least like naturally occurring idea for what your gimmick would be in Great Falls, Montana, but like I am excited for a full report from her. Well, the thing I would say to you and Roderick, and I know you guys know this because you're both smart, is, and this is something, I mean, Andrew and I crossed this Rubicon 1,000 episodes ago, but we realized, I think, Andrew, I don't want to speak for you, but I feel like we try to pick topics that we think will be interesting to the listeners, but really what makes the show is us talking and our interactions. And obviously there's more of a research component to what you guys are doing. There's the topics themselves are fascinating, but you and Roderick talking and your guys' interaction are so – it's so fun and delightful that it's like – honestly, if it's Doritos or four-dimensional figures, it's like I'm interested in it because you guys are talking about it. So as long as you guys remind yourselves of that to take the pressure off a little bit.
I remember this epiphany I had many years ago. I read this Stefan Fatsis book called Word Freak about mm-hmm. Scrabble champs. Yes. Do you guys know this book? Mm-hmm. And his approach is he really digs into the minutiae of the game. Like he is not ashamed to just spend pages on, you know, when you use a J or, you know, like the weird kinds of numerical stuff. You know, he just goes into great detail. And I kind of realized that like that's what made that book like – like really going deep mm-hmm. on something. It almost doesn't matter what the thing is. Like I don't mm-hmm. care about Scrabble champions, but if you have the right storyteller who like will mm-hmm. just tell you everything, like it just puts you in a new place or whatever. And like it's like you can go through boring out the other side into interesting. That's a good tag for a podcast.
We're getting so close. No, we've almost broken through. We're almost 3,000 episodes in, Ken, and it's like the wall in front of us is getting lighter. Some light is starting to come through. We can just see the beginnings of the other side of when this gets interesting again. By the way, Stefan Fatsis has another book that is I just can't ever get it out of my mind, where he tries to become a place kicker for the Denver Broncos. And like he was a very competent college soccer player. And everybody who watches football is just kind of like, I could probably do that. And he just, it's so hard. And it's physically so demanding to be, Sebastian Janikowski being the exception to that rule. But like,
he's the guy that makes everyone think like, any soccer player could probably.
Okay, maybe I have to cut down on drunk. Smoking. But
you can be drunk during the game, you're sea bass. But that Fatsis book is just like, it really stuck with me too, just because of the, you know, I don't know, just how hard it is to actually, how bad he was. When he actually got out there and tried to kick, they let him. Somehow the Broncos let him kick in a preseason game, which is also, by the way, like that's disrespectful to the other team. There's people trying to make the squad. And you're like, and now on the field, Stefan Fatsis.
Did the Lions ever let George Plimpton play? That he played in preseason, right?
Oh, I forgot about that.
I think it was the same thing.
Yeah, paper lion. I have a story about that. Which was that, like, I talked to George Plimpton one time on the phone when I was a booker on an NPR show, and it was because of the, like, 20th anniversary of that book. Mm-hmm. And he was so cool and exactly how you would hope George Plimpton would be. I called the Paris Review. He answered the phone. I was like, hi, Mr. Plimpton. I work for an NPR show. We would like to have you on Monday morning for the anniversary of Paper Lion. And he said, I won't do like a George Plimpton impression, but he said like, oh, that sounds lovely. I'm actually going to Detroit because they're going to do a ceremony at halftime. And but I'm flying back to New York that next Monday morning. So he was giving me the times. And somehow I can't remember exactly how it happened, but it was basically like I said, well, if you'll be able to do it that morning. And he said something to the effect of like, well, I might be a little hungover Monday morning if everything goes well in Detroit. Like George Plimpton at the Paris Review planning on getting kind of wasted in Detroit. Celebrating the book. I don't know why that just was like – not even that that's his brand, but I just loved how normal and relatable he seemed to be for a guy who was, you know, pretty erudite.
People my age might have seen him first. He used to host for some reason some Donald Duck cartoon anthology on the Disney Channel in the 80s.
What?
So they'd cut from a Donald Duck cartoon. And it would be him sitting in an armchair like Alistair Cook on Masterpiece Theater saying like, once again, the duck – falls short in his battle against, you know.
Was that a meta joke?
I think. And as a kid, I just thought, what a weird affect. Why do they get this guy? But that must have just been the funny meta joke of the show was, like, why is this
George
happening
Plimpton
between
breaks
cartoons?
Down cartoons.
He also did a whole series of commercials. You might know what the game console was. We did a bunch of game console commercials.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, that were like whatever the Atari competitor was at the time, something I don't recall. And the commercial, I was watching them recently for something. And
Coleco?
Yeah, they might have been Coleco, I think. And it was hilarious because he's showing the difference between like Atari looks like this, Coleco looks like this, and it is they're just both so terrible. Like the distinction between the bad graphics are so minimal.
Dude, there's nothing better than the commercials that are trapped in the amber of like YouTube videos that are ostensibly yeah. about something else.
Yeah.
Or like I will read these old National Geographics at my parents' house, not even for the articles, but for the like four ads at the beginning of the National Geographic, because just the like just to see what was futuristic technology in 1986. I'm never not delighted by that stuff.
Me
so.
Too.
Speaking of never not being delightful, Ken Jennings, thank you very much for being on TBTL today. We really appreciate it,
oh,
man.
It's always a pleasure, you guys. Anytime.
I want you to know that even if someday you are only the second longest running Jeopardy contestant, you'll still have a place on TBTL. Even when the world turns its back on you, when the spotlight turns off of you, we will we'll still be here for you, okay?
I don't
That's
believe
a promise.
It. You guys are going to go to James Holzhauer in a New York minute the second he's...
Yeah.
And you're going to be like,
by the way?
And you're going to be like, we always liked you better than Ken, by the way. Can we just tell you, James, always better.
Yeah. Well, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. Ken, thanks for being on TBTL. Everybody check out the Omnibus podcast and all the other stuff. Where should people go to get like kind of everything that you're constantly creating?
I'm at Ken Jennings on Twitter. If you're interested in the books and whatnot, you know, if you want to look at Planet Funny, how comedy took over our culture, for example, there's excerpts at my website, which is ken-jennings.com.
All right, Ken, thanks, man.
Thanks. All right, I know you know about TBTL, the podcast. You're listening to it right now. But have you tried TBTL, the newsletter? Because you can. Just go over to tbtl.net and click on the button that says sign me up for the TBTL newsletter. I gotta say, it's a lot of fun. Every week, Luke and I record a little video that we include in the newsletter. It's called Hey Dummies. We answer your questions, any questions you want to ask us. Well, there's all kinds of things in the newsletter. Don't take my word for it here. This is Mary. She's a big fan of the newsletter.
It has a nice welcome introduction, but then you have these phenomenal GIFs that are so much fun. You talk about amazing, wonderful people, and you introduce us to new things. And then the songs of the week. Oh, my gosh. And it just makes me so happy.
It can make you happy, too. I mean, listen, this is coming from Mary. She doesn't even listen to the podcast. She's here just for the newsletter. No joke. So, again, go to tbtl.net and click on the button that says sign me up for the TBTL newsletter. And we'll try to bring a little extra sunshine to your inbox every Friday afternoon.
All right, let's do some music for your weekend. And Andrew, at the top of the show, we were talking about my freak out during the Vanniversary shows, which, by the way, you ain't seen nothing yet. In the words of, who is that, Bachman Turner Overdrive?
Is that your song?
No, but wait till we get to Australia.
Yeah.
You're going to see some freak outs. But we were talking about time and the timing of those shows. And I had this song by The Creation is the name of the band. And the song is called Making Time. Now, I would never know about a band called The Creation or a song called Making Time, except for the fact that it is on the Rushmore soundtrack. Mm-hmm. I have a feeling that when you hear this, it'll make sense. So you'll recognize it.
And that's the same soundtrack, because there is that Kinks song that is now like one of my favorite songs in the world. And I only know about it, or maybe I am as familiar with it because you told me about it, right? And it's on the same soundtrack?
Probably. There definitely are. Wes Anderson definitely loves Kinks songs.
Okay.
And I knew very little about the Kinks. Like, Picture Book, is that the one you're thinking of, or no?
I think that's an album by theirs. I don't know if I know the song. It's like...
Oh, well, there is a Kinks...
Why did I do this? It's like one of my favorite songs, and I know it from you, and now I can't think of the name of it.
Hmm. Well, I'm sure we'll get
that.
Maybe you could make... Hey, how about you make that your song, your music for your weekend? Oh, you already...
I got another song that I want to play for you.
Great.
Strangers.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, there it is. I'm really sorry. Boy, that was clunky as hell. But yeah, Strangers, that song. It never really was on my radar until you're like, oh, yeah, I love the song from the soundtrack. And then I listened to it. And now, I mean,
I think
when
it's
I lived
on
in
the
LA,
Darjeeling Limited soundtrack.
Oh, is that it?
Is why, okay. is why I was having trouble placing it. But that song is like, I honestly... I would say I cry 70% of the time that I listen to that
yes,
song.
Yes, and that ended up becoming a like a huge California song for me. Like, I was only in California for 2 years, maybe a little bit more, and there are certain songs, like mm-hmm. A Club Blown Up on a Tuesday, also by the Kinks, and Strangers and a few other things that really stand out that I went through my phase with those songs during that time. But anyway, I'm sorry. That is not your music for your weekend, nor mine.
So here we go with... Making Time by The Creation. Take a listen. It's like, this is such a Wes Anderson identified song now that if I was going to make a commercial that was a parody of a Wes Anderson movie or like the Wes Anderson aesthetic, I would use this song.
That's funny because, I mean, I recognize it, but I don't even associate this with Wes Anderson. This
oh,
to
you
me
knew
is
about
like
it
a,
before. Beforehand.
I wouldn't have known it was The Creation, but I know this song and it reminds me. It's more... Take it back to yesterday's conversation. This would have been the type of music that would have kind of heavily inspired the Farmer's Daughters.
I was going to joke and say, would you listen to this in the donut shop
this
when
is
you were
exactly,
spray painting?
This kind of classic rock guitar driven, but also more than just like wonking around. Like, this is, I like this shit.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I don't know anything else about the band The Creation, but you might want to check them out. All right. What do you got for us, Mr. Walsh?
I have a brand new song that just came in over the transom. This is another band that I had never heard of before.
I love that
this
you
week.
Have a transom. You've had a transom this whole time.
Yes.
Of these labels emailing you songs, but I feel like this is the first that you're informing me of this, and this is great. The last song you played off of this this particular, I don't know what you'd call it.
Channel.
Was really good, so I'm
yeah.
looking forward to this.
This is a little bit of a grander sort of feel. I was listening to it this morning. It's by a group, and I believe they're a duo, although I know nothing about them at all, called Olden Yoke. That's hard to say.
Yeah, that's how I order my eggs, by the way,
Olden
at Denny's.
Exactly. Over hard. No, just Olden Yoke.
Just Olden Yoke.
That'll do it. And you know what? I didn't think this out. I don't even know how to say it's Grand Palais or Palais. Palais. Can you look that up?
Can you use it in a sentence?
That Palais was grand.
Country of origin.
Palais. How would you... Here, I think... is it a French word for palace, maybe?
Palais.
Hmm. Yes. The Grand Palais Hotel. You said Palais?
Yeah.
That looks like... Well, I'll tell you, there is a lot of stuff showing up in, like, Eastern Europe and Europe for that. So whatever that means.
Palais.
Anyway, according to Google, it says it's French for palace. We'll see.
Ooh, good guess.
But this is a Grand Palais by Olden Yoke. I'm just glad I was able to get into it cleanly. Mm-hmm.
I am doing the best that I can.
I can hear this in a Wes Anderson movie, too.
Oh, my God. I can see them in a Wes Anderson movie. Look at the picture of Olden Yoke.
Yeah, I saw that earlier. They are really Wes Anderson. They are like, right?
Boy, they are absolutely delivering on visually on what you think the sound would indicate.
It's
this
nice,
is
though, isn't it?
I really like it.
Let me read you a little bit from the press release about it. So this is going to be coming... this is on their upcoming sophomore album, which will be coming out on Friday the 17th. It's called Trouble in Mind. Apparently this song, Grand Palais, is about, quote, the frivolous search to seek some semblance of spiritual understanding in various places, things, and people outside of ourselves.
Let me mention that they're going to be out and about touring May 16th. They'll be in Brooklyn at Baby's All Right. They'll be at the Lily Pad in Cambridge, Massachusetts on the 17th, and Jerry's on Front in Philadelphia, May 18th. And their Bandcamp page has all of these dates. I'm trying to figure out if they're going to be...
Yep, Seattle on Sunday the 23rd of June at the Sunset Tavern.
Oh, man, that's a
nice
fun
as in
place.
Ballard, right?
Indeed.
Yeah,
so,
that's a great place.
A Bailey's Corner Store on Whidbey Island, June 22nd. The Happy Dog in Cleveland.
That is so funny. You're seeing... I'm looking at the press release list. I think they've added some dates because that June 22nd one isn't there.
The Happy Dog. Have you ever graffitied the Happy Dog in Cleveland, Ohio?
I did. Yeah. I did.
Okay.
I'll send out the address later.
All right. So here we go. This is our listener suggestion, and it is the end of our broadcast week. It's from listener Chad. He says, hey, guys. Have you heard this one off the yet-to-be-released record by Stephen Malkmus and the Jicks?
Oh, I didn't know that he got back together with the Jicks.
It's quite a departure in sound, but I'm digging it, and I hope you do, too. Huh. Now, Andrew, when I clicked on this link, I was like, 100% chance this is a cat roll.
Oh,
like,
yeah, that
I
sounds
literally
like
clicked
a perfect
on it so
little
I could
trap.
Just, so I could just be mad. It's like, oh, listener Chad, you know what Andrew and I like.
Uh-huh.
You sort of like set the trap. You baited it with something that was perfect for me. Oh, yeah, new Stephen Malkmus and the Jicks.
Right.
But I was surprised to find that it's actually a link to Stephen Malkmus and the Jicks. And this new song that they have off this new record, it is a total departure. I'm going to say I don't even think it's really for me. But I dig Stephen Malkmus, and I dig the Jicks, and I think there's going to be a bunch of listeners, like listener Chad, who really like this. One other thing, Chad is in Portland, and his auto signature is sent from my iPhone while listening to TBTL. Now,
oh,
I don't know. See, I can't. I don't
that
know.
That would be amazing.
Is every person who gets a text from Chad in Portland, are they finding out that he's listening to TBTL, or did he just do that for our edification?
Can we make this a marketing thing right now?
Yes.
A guerrilla marketing thing? If you're comfortable doing it, and if
also
you have,
if you're not,
and also if you're not, if you have a signature at the bottom of your email, change it to that and make TBTL a hyperlink to the website. That would be a great way. Like, how many people might just like randomly click on that? Be like listening to TBTL. You click on it. Maybe they check out the show. Maybe we double our audience in a week.
That would be... We got to figure out a prize or a thank you prize for... We have to incentivize people to do this. Maybe just the fact that there'll be more listeners is an incentive enough.
If we get more listeners, we will do a show at Jamie's house.
All right, so do you
Jamie
have,
will do a show at our house.
Do
How
you
about
have
that?
This... And she'll bring Stephen Malkmus and the Jicks, who are just done playing a show at Sunstroke House.
What's it called?
I don't know. I just have the link to it.
I don't think I've seen whatever you're working on.
Oh,
off
right.
Of.
You're right, right. Okay. So I'll play it from here. Okay. I have the technology. I can do this. And take a listen to... Give me a second here while I boot this up. Probably some sort of a YouTube ad. Yes, there is a YouTube ad that I have to wait for it to
Do you know that finish? I've installed this ad blocker that a listener suggested a long time ago, and it's really... Like, I don't have to deal with YouTube... ads anymore, which is really, really great for the show. Although I feel guilty about it because a lot of websites I go to, they're like, hey, man, we're just journalists trying to do our work here.
I know.
Do you
I
mind
got,
turning off
I got,
the ad blocker?
I got,
it kills me
I got shamed
time.
Off of whitelisting by all of these websites. That are like, we noticed that you're doing this to us. Why are you doing this to me,
right,
Al?
And honestly, I mean, it's content. I feel like advertising has a role in making sure that I can read a New York Times article,
etc. Is the computer named Hal? So he'd be saying, why are you doing this to me, Dave? Isn't Dave the guy that's in the thing?
Right. Where's Dave, man? That's
exactly.
where that whole thing came from.
Actually,
Where's Dave, man?
That's when it's time for us to be done for the week. When that is the funniest joke I've ever heard in my life, because it honestly is.
I would make it a show title, except that makes no sense without the voice.
All right, here's Stephen Malkmus. It's called Victor Borgia. Remember Victor Borgia, those ads?
No.
Oh, man. Victor Borgia was a kind of piano comedian, and he used to have a joke where he would, in fact, if you go Victor Borgia, this is not, Carrie is out in the hall being like, get us out of here. But Victor Borgia was like a comic musician, and they would play ads for his like video special. And I remember one joke he had is he used to play, I guess, is that William Tell or what's the?
It's either William Tell or the 1812.
So he'd play that, and then he would turn the music that was on, like the paper music, you know what I mean? Like, then he would turn the music over.
Like
he was playing the music upside down.
Yeah.
So that was a Victor Borgia bit that I remember from being a kid.
Where's Victor, man?
Nope. This is why when it's time to end the show,
Let's go.
Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be back here on Monday with more Imaginary Radio for you. Until then, enjoy your weekend. Go Mariners. Go eat a bagel. And please remember, no mountain too tall.
And good luck to all.
We can go. Your eyes are like a present from a peasant. Oh, and I cherish them so.
Power out.